Today, 34 years after the murder of Daniel Morgan, why has no one ever been brought to justice? In his 20 years working for The Guardian as a crime correspondent, there was one mysterious story that never went away for Duncan Campbell.
It was a night in 1987. It was a crowded pub, Golden Lion. It was a popular pub in those days for both police officers and private detectives to meet. And amongst the customers was one Daniel Morgan. Drinks were taken. We know some tiny details from it. We bought a couple of packets of crisps and so on. And then at some stage later in the evening, he went outside. And the next thing we know, his body was found with an axe in the back of his head, lying in the car park.
The killing of Daniel Morgan is one of Britain's most famous unsolved murder cases.
The 9 o'clock news from the BBC.
What was missing was his expensive Rolex watch. What was still there was more than £1,000 in cash. So was it a robbery? It didn't look like it. So what was it and who done it? And that, all these years later, all these many millions of pounds worth of investigation, we still don't know.
The body of 37-year-old Daniel Morgan was found in Sydenham in southeast London. He'd worked as a specialist in debt collection for an investigation company. He was found axed to death in the pub car park.
We may not know who committed the crime, but we are still discussing this case that has been littered with police failures. And the reason for that is in large part down to one man's unwavering perseverance, Daniel's brother, Alistair Morgan.
I'll say to you, if you're an ordinary Joe in this country and you're faced with where you suspect corruption of the most serious kind, police corruption and cover-up in relation to a murder, literally, it takes decades before anyone in power will listen.
Decades, indeed. 34 years since it happened, there has still been no conviction. But Alistair's long fight has achieved something huge.
Today, an independent panel laid bare the serious failings of the Metropolitan Police. It said, put reputation before the truth.
Last week, an official inquiry into the case came to the damning conclusion that the Metropolitan Police, which handled the case from the start, was and still is institutionally corrupt.
This is one of the most devastating episodes in the history of the Metropolitan Police.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, what the multiple failed investigations into the murder of Daniel Morgan tell us about the Met. Duncan Campbell, you came to this story in the 1990s as a reporter for The Guardian. And in the decade since then, you've been trying to piece together the jigsaw. It's a sprawling story with various threads and multiple characters. Let's start with the person at the centre of it all, Daniel Morgan himself. Who was he?
Daniel Morgan was a private detective at the time that he was murdered, working for Southern Investigations. Prior to that, he'd done various jobs. He'd worked in sales in Denmark. He'd been a guide to the English countryside, but he'd finally settled on a job as a private detective. And at the age of 37, married with two children, that's the job that he had with Southern Investigations, which is at the centre of the inquiry.
Alistair, how close were you to your brother, Daniel? Did you get on well?
After the death of my father, I was 16 and Dan was 15. My sister was 13. You know, we didn't have a father, so we all looked out for each other, you know? So we knew each other very well. His hobby was restoring old cars. He loved nothing better than having his head underneath the bonnet of an old car and repairing it and respraying it. And he was a nice guy, you know. He was very gregarious.
What did you know about his life in the years running up to his death?
Towards the end of his life, I understood that he was very unhappy with the business partnership that he was in. And he was complaining about his partner, Jonathan Rees, spending, you know, half his life propping up the bar with CID people, because he had, as historically it's well known, he had a lot of contacts with corrupt police.
Tell me about Daniel's work.
It involved a number of things. Private detectives don't have quite such a glamorous life as portrayed in film.
Daniel's colleagues describe him as a workaholic. It was nothing for him to drive in his BMW, to do a job in East Anglia, maybe go on to another in the Midlands, and perhaps manage a third in the West Country, all in a single day. They were mostly dirty jobs, though, that other people didn't want to do.
They're hired often to be involved in divorce cases, to find out damaging material about a husband or a wife so that somebody can secure a divorce, to find out if employees are fiddling stuff from companies.
And it was obviously South London. It was the 1980s, a different world to today, and one in which it sounds like there was this kaleidoscope of contacts between these private investigators, the police, the media, even criminals maybe, all mixing together in long sessions in the pub. Tell me about that time.
It was a very different time for both policing and for reporting as crime correspondents, partly because there was within the detective branch of the Metropolitan Police at that stage quite a lot of corruption. It was also a time when relations between the police and reporters could be very convivial. There was a big drinking culture. It was a very male, very white culture, and relationships were established between police officers and reporters. Quite often this meant money changing hands. One of my former colleagues, now no longer with us, used to meet detectives every week in a bar and hand over brown envelopes with cash inside them. Not enormous amount of cash, £50, £100, whatever, as a thank you for stories that they might have given him during that week. Those kind of payoffs were fairly standard practice. At the same time, some detectives at high end were also taking money from criminals, and this was very much the culture of the time. One was in a slightly different position at The Guardian. The Guardian never pays money for stories in that respect. So there was never an expectation when I would be talking, or a Guardian crime reporter would be talking to an officer, that you would hand them a brown envelope at the end of it. They used to joke about it.
Alistair, you said that in the run-up to his death, your brother was unhappy. Why did you think that?
I mean, generally, he was a happy person, always was, as a kid, growing up. Towards the end of his life, he was worried about a lot of things, and he'd also repeatedly expressed concerns about police corruption. Nothing specific, but I can remember talking to him. We were talking about the area in which he lived, and he said, talking about bent cops, and he said, "Alistair, they're all over the place down here."
A private detective called Daniel Morgan was found dead in a car park of a pub in South London. It was gruesome. He'd been killed with an axe.
Can you describe the moment you found out what had happened to your brother?
I was at my grandmother's in Petersfield, and it was very early in the morning, and the phone started ringing. I think it must have been about 5:30 or 6 o'clock, and I thought, goodness, what's... You know, my grandmother at that time was in her 80s, and I thought, who's ringing an old lady at 6 o'clock in the morning? I got up and quickly answered the phone, and it was my mother. And she said to me, "Brace yourself, Alistair, because I've got some bad news for you." And I was, of course, thinking, oh, my God, what's happened now? And she said, "Daniel's dead." And, of course, you know, I was shocked by this. And I said to her, "What's happened to him? What's happened to him?"
Welcome. In this month's programme, we need you to be a real-life armchair detective on some of Britain's most notorious crimes.
Reconstructions tonight include a robbery in which treasured family paintings were taken and a case you might have seen in the headlines, the murder of a private detective as he left a pub in South London.
Duncan, no one has been convicted for the murder of Daniel Morgan, so inevitably we don't have a complete narrative as to what happened in the run-up to his death. But there are theories, aren't there, about what may have been going on. What are those theories?
The first major theory was that he was about to blow the whistle both on colleagues and on bent coppers, and therefore that was why he had to die. There was also a suggestion that Jonathan Rees, his partner, and Morgan were having big arguments. Another theory was put forward, and painful for the Morgan family, was that both Rees and Morgan had been having affairs with people, and maybe an angry boyfriend or an angry brother or an angry husband had come up and whacked him in the head. None of the theories have been stood up either by the police investigating the murder or by the panel now reviewing it.
Obviously, Rees denies that there were tensions over the business or that Morgan was about to reveal corruption.
Like, Daniel was my friend. People keep talking about fractions between us. There wasn't any.
Arguments between you?
Yeah, we did a small, tight business working on a tight budget. And Daniel was absolutely brilliant at what he did as the bailiff. And he was ruthless about that. And he earned me a lot, or earned the firm a lot of money. It was a partnership. Him dying caused me a massive amount of grief financially and business-wise, because the partnership ceased to exist.
Let's go right back to the start, to the minutes and hours after the murder took place. We know that that is the most critical time in an investigation. What did officers do?
There was a very bungled investigation. A crime scene like that should have been sealed off. Any witnesses in the pub should have been checked out, noted. Any alibis of anybody in the vicinity that night should have been checked out. Very little of that was done. It was accepted that this was a bungled inquiry.
Douglas Campbell is looking for anyone who was in the Golden Lion in Sydenham Road on that evening, but you're also trying to find who sold this axe. Now, this actually isn't the murder weapon.
Now, that is a replica we bought, but it's identical to the murder weapon.
So, Alistair, what did you do after that phone call from your mum?
I thought, well, I've got to ring Daniel's partner. I had to wait for several hours, in fact, until I knew the office would be open. So I rang his partner. I asked him what had happened to Daniel, and he told me that they, i.e. he and Daniel, had a meeting in a pub in Sydenham. That after this meeting, Daniel had been bludgeoned to death, is what he said. And I was, suspicious.
Alistair's head was spinning. He rushed to London to try to work out what had happened. And the next day, he found himself speaking to officers running the case.
I told them, I went over suspicions that I had in my mind about who was responsible and the motive for it. Must have been in there at least an hour with these two officers, explaining and going over why I thought this, and why I thought that. And I left. I felt neither officer was taking any notes at all. And I just thought, I just felt deeply uneasy.
Alistair was right to feel uneasy. Not only had officers failed to properly handle the crime scene, but it soon emerged that the man in charge of the case, one of the ones he had been speaking to, had direct links to his brother's business partner.
One of the extraordinary factors in it is that one of the original investigating officers was Sid Fillery, who was a drinking chum of Jonathan Rees, and obviously, there's something very dubious and unprofessional about a police officer being involved in an investigation in which one of the suspects is a close drinking partner.
The police described the case as a sticker. In other words, it's one they just can't solve. For nearly 30 hours, they did hold for questioning Daniel Morgan's partner, John Rees, and two of Rees's relations. And, as you may have read, three policemen were also questioned, but they've been eliminated from the murder inquiry. But nothing else to go on.
Alistair, Sid Fillery was taken off the case, and actually he, two other officers, Jonathan Rees and two of Rees's brothers-in-law, the Vian brothers, were all arrested, but quickly released without charge. A year later, you were no closer to justice, and an inquest was held into your brother's death, in which more emerged about these links between private investigators and the police. And there were some pretty astonishing claims. What was said?
Well, we arrived in London, my family arrived in London, and there were photographers and press all over the place when we went into the inquest. And the first witness was a bookkeeper whom Jonathan Rees had taken on to do the books for the company. And we were bewildered, you know, what's this? What's a bookkeeper doing giving evidence here? And then he got into the witness box and basically told the coroner's court that Rees had asked him to find someone to kill Daniel, and that his plan was that after Daniel's murder, Sid Fillery and he would go into partnership. We were staggered by this testimony. Given under oath, it was certainly something that deserved to be treated with the utmost seriousness. And it wasn't.
Rees has always strongly denied taking any part in Morgan's death. But the suggestion that there were links between him and Fillery were certainly true, and the links were about to get even stronger.
The astonishing thing was that Fillery, having left the police, then joins Southern Investigations and becomes a partner of Rees. And I think that the inquiry describes their relationship as close and unprofessional, which is perhaps a little bit of an understatement.
Rees denies that his ties to Fillery had any impact on the investigation.
Listen, what influence would I have over this case or any case at all? I'd have no influence whatsoever. I couldn't change things. I couldn't go out and tell a policeman or a senior policeman or a detective and give them don't investigate that, please, because it might be embarrassing for me or cause me problems.
But their relationship certainly did seem to fit in the world that Duncan described earlier, linking police officers to private investigators and to newspaper journalists.
Another intriguing part of the story was the involvement of Southern Investigations, in particular Jonathan Rees and Sid Fillery, with the News of the World, selling them information, being employed by the News of the World to investigate people, and large sums of money being exchanged. So there was this real, very deep relationship.
Alistair, nothing had happened for you in this case. You were no closer to a conviction and you were getting frustrated. So you turned to the media. Do you remember when you first met The Guardian's Duncan Campbell?
I do. I think it was 1994 I first met Duncan. And as a result of that, Duncan published an article in G2. And I was delighted with this because somebody taking my concerns seriously in the national media.
So Duncan, Alistair had come to you 7 years after his brother's death. Can you take me through what officers were actually doing?
Well, there was a series of police investigations. The first one kind of came to a halt. Then Hampshire police were brought in to have a look at second investigation. There was a third, a fourth, and finally a fifth investigation.
Welcome to BBC London News. The family of a man murdered in southeast London are criticising the Metropolitan Police for not finding his killers. They say the Met's commissioner has failed to provide answers to who killed private investigator Daniel Morgan.
They never came up with quite enough for a substantial court case. There were a number of charges made. Jonathan Rees was charged at some stage, along with the Vian brothers, and Fillery as involved peripherally as well.
So inquiries seemed to keep coming round to the same group?
Yes, to a great extent, as Rees himself would acknowledge, he was seen very much as a chief suspect and targeted to that extent, he would claim unfairly.
Jonathan Rees has always maintained his innocence. He and others connected to the case spoke about the murder in a Channel 4 documentary last year.
There was no evidence ever of us being involved in the murder of Daniel Morgan. What's difficult about that?
And Rees's friend Sid Fillery was the detective accused of actively undermining the first murder inquiry.
I'm the only person, me and the murderer, who know I wasn't involved.
The thrust of many of the inquiries was to find out if there was enough evidence against him to secure a conviction. At this stage, the police got bugs that they were able to put in people's houses with permission. And because there was a bug in Rees's home, they found that he was involved with another man in attempting to plant cocaine on a woman. The client wanted custody of his children, and the plan was to have the wife arrested for drugs offences. This became clear through the bugging. As a result of that, Rees was arrested and jailed for 6 years, along with two other men.
And through all those years, Alistair kept pushing and pushing. And when it came to the fifth investigation, there was some hope, wasn't there? But that went wrong as well. Tell me what happened.
This is an interesting one in many respects. Dave Cook, esteemed Scottish detective, was brought in. Like detectives in this case, did talk to the press, did try to stimulate responses from people who might come up with information.
I'm here tonight to reinvestigate it with the advantage of 15 years of knowledge and hopefully through this appeal get the nugget of information which will solve this case.
And that, in the end, was what derailed the inquiry, because the people who came up and offered information were criminals or former criminals, and their evidence just didn't stand up. And some of it was invented and some of it couldn't possibly be true.
In a weird twist, it later turned out that Dave Cook had been spied on during the investigation and that his wife, Jackie Hames, had had her phone hacked by the News of the World. Alistair, tell me how you felt when you found out that even this investigation had collapsed.
I remember David ringing me up one morning. I think it may have been in the spring. But he said to me, the investigation had sent a file to the CPS, and the CPS had said, no, not enough evidence. And I was, this was, God knows, again, about 20 years after the murder. And I was, I think, deeply disappointed is a mild way of saying it.
You'd been pushing for justice for nearly a quarter of a century by then, and it had just totally collapsed. There was no sign of justice being possible. And then in 2011, the Met Police commented on the original case. What did they say?
There were two people that commented it. One was a superintendent who was outside the Old Bailey. It wasn't even a trial. It was a pre-trial hearing when the prosecution collapsed. And he said that the first investigation had been tainted by corruption. That was the first admission of something that I'd known for a quarter of a century. After the admission, the acting commissioner told the Metropolitan Police Authority that the first investigation had been tainted by corruption and a failure over many years to deal with that corruption.
That admission by the Met was key to allowing Alistair to push even harder, and in particular, take his brother's case to the Home Secretary at the time.
Very soon after this, we approached Theresa May, and she then offered us a panel of inquiry. We discussed it at length. We would have preferred a judicial inquiry because they have statutory powers. But after 25 years, we were exhausted, worried, and we decided that we would accept this offer of a panel of inquiry.
An independent panel will now examine claims police officers were involved in the murder, that corruption protected the killers. It'll trace back to the 80s the links between police, private investigators and newspapers.
The collapse of the case may have paved the way for a panel inquiry into the way that Daniel Morgan's murder had been handled. but it also allowed the men who had been treated as key suspects to sue the Met Police for malicious prosecution.
After the failure of the prosecution, Rees, the Vian brothers and Fillery all took an action against the police. After their appeal, they were awarded more than £400,000 in damages.
Coming up, 34 years on, the panel releases its findings into what went wrong in the Daniel Morgan murder case.
Today's report isn't about who killed Daniel Morgan. It's about why, 34 years on, we're still not in a position to say who carried out that murder and why nobody has been brought to justice for it.
I want to say a word about the panel's remit. The panel was established on the 10th of May 2013 by the then Home Secretary Theresa May to shine a light on the circumstances of Daniel Morgan's murder, its background, and the handling of the case since 1987. In so doing, we have addressed three issues.
Duncan, I know you spent 8 hours reading the 1,200 pages of this panel report. Can you take me through the key findings? What did it reveal?
It reveals quite a bit of what we already knew, that there was incompetence, that there was delay.
From the moment of his murder, there were serious failures of investigation, both at the scene, which was never searched, and during the first investigation. Many opportunities to gather in evidence were irretrievably lost during that first investigation. The forensic work was described by a senior officer in the second investigation as pathetic.
The panel found that even the people they were trying to get information from 30 years later feared reprisals and therefore wouldn't talk to them. The other major part of the inquiry was that the numbers of corrupt officers connected to suspects, more than 10 officers, were convicted and jailed for other offences, not connected with the murder at all, but just to give you the impression of the kind of associates that some of the suspects were involved with.
From the beginning, as you know, there are allegations that police officers were involved in the murder and that corruption by police officers played a part in protecting the murderers from being brought to justice.
They found that the coroner in the original inquest had inaccurately said afterwards that there was no evidence of police involvement. They also found that some officers who had made complaints or expressed worries about the possibility of corruption amongst their fellows were then ostracised by their colleagues.
As I said, the Metropolitan Police concealed from the family of Daniel Morgan and from the wider public the failings in the first murder investigation and the role of corrupt officers. That lack of candour over so many years has been a barrier to proper police accountability.
Probably the bit of the report that got most headlines was the suggestion that the Met Police was institutionally corrupt, not only in 1987, but even today. It's a very dramatic phrase and it has echoes of the biggest ever previous finding about the Met, that it was institutionally racist in the wake of Stephen Lawrence's murder. How did they reach that conclusion and what has been the response to it?
In some ways, their main feeling was that the Metropolitan Police throughout had dragged their feet in making data available, that some of the information they sought was not made available until March of this year.
The family of Daniel Morgan has suffered grievously as a consequence of the failure to bring his murderer or murderers to justice, the unwarranted assurances which they were given, the misinformation which was put into the public domain, and the denial of failings in the investigation, including failings to acknowledge professional incompetence, individuals' venal behaviour, and managerial and organisational failures. We believe that concealing or denying failings for the sake of an organisation's public image is dishonesty on the part of the organisation for reputational benefit. This constitutes a form of institutional corruption.
The response from the top of the Metropolitan Police has been that Yes, there were terrible mistakes made. Yes, we have to learn from them. Yes, the family were let down. And yes, we regret that. But that things have changed very much since then. And I would say that to a great extent, a lot of that is true. There is not the institutional corruption that was prevalent at the time in the 70s and 60s, 70s and early 80s. But I think by not being open, by not sharing the data, by making it difficult for the panel, they inevitably arise suspicions as to why, what have they got to hide?
I don't think, however, in my experience anyway, and of course I do need to read the report, I don't see that that adds up to a concept of institutional corruption. It isn't what I see every day now, and it isn't my experience over 31 years. I think
Tell me what you made of the panel's findings.
I feel vindicated. Never in history has this happened, this kind of conclusions to a panel of inquiry. And, of course, that is a great relief to me. You know, after being snubbed and bullied and lied to, and, you know, this is an extraordinary result.
It wasn't just about corruption at the time. It was about corruption in the Met now. And that's what they've tried to deny. What would you say?
I would say that the resistance that the panel met in getting documents from the Metropolitan Police was outrageous. And they've said this set back their work by years, probably. And in the interim, my mother died. They put every obstacle they could in the way of the work of the panel. And to me, that's a form of corruption. Cover-up, reputation management.
What has it meant to you to have fought this hard and this long?
In part, I feel exhausted. There's this sort of underlying mental and emotional exhaustion, but at the same time, I feel proud of what me and my family have done. I'll say, well, if you mess with my family to the Met, you will regret it. Yeah? I mean, I was the oldest male, surviving male in my family at the time of the murder. I was 38 years old. You know, I feel as a man, my job is to protect my family. And that's what I've done to the very best of my ability.
Alistair, at the start of this, you told me about when the phone rang and you heard about Daniel from your mum. And you said, what happened? We still don't know. How frustrating is that?
Well, I know what happened. I mean, I'm satisfied that I personally know who killed my brother. But at the same time, I don't think we will ever have what you call justice for Daniel, i.e. the perpetrators convicted.
Alistair, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Anushka.
That was Alistair Morgan and Duncan Campbell. My thanks to both of them. Do read The Guardian's coverage of that recent report into the investigation into Daniel's murder. You can find it on the website. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.